News Radio. I'm Peter Alexander at the White House. The early onset of influenza has the nation in its grips. As NBC's Brian Moore reports, parts of the East Coast are being hit hard.
New York State has already seen more than 19,000 flu cases, nearly five times the number seen at this time last year. Officials at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control say the flu is widespread right now in 47 states. Children have been especially hard hit, with 20 deaths reported.
While many parts of the eastern U.S. are unseasonably warm, the West Coast is experiencing temperatures below freezing. NBC meteorologist Dylan Dreyer on the state of frozen cactus.
Frigid air is just hanging over the western U.S., temperatures in the 20s in California overnight. And blizzard conditions in much of New Mexico. In Arizona, a rare sight, icicles and cactus. Farmers there are fighting the frost, trying to save the citrus crop.
This is NBC News Radio. As the president's gun safety task force completes work on possible changes to existing gun laws, NBC's Kristen Welker says gun sales have shot up.
A month after the Newtown shooting, gun stores tell NBC News they've seen an uptick in sales. Owners stocking up out of fear the Obama administration will impose stiffer laws. In December, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System reported 2.2 million background checks were performed last month, an increase of about 58% over the same period in 2011.
There are big protests in Paris today. As many as 300,000 people are expected to descend on the city to demonstrate against same-sex marriage. France's president has promised to legalize gay marriage. Egypt's ousted former president and his security chief will get a new trial. A court granted Hosni Mubarak's appeal of his life sentence. He's charged with failing to prevent the killing of hundreds of protesters during the uprising that toppled his regime. I'm Peter Alexander, NBC News Radio.
GEICO presents a thank you letter from your RV.
Breaker, breaker 19, I just wanted to say thanks. Ever since GEICO helped you save money on your RV insurance, we've been doing a lot more road tripping. We've been everywhere, even Vegas. But don't worry, good buddy, I got your taillights covered. Your secrets are safer than a corn muffin in a chicken coop. Just go with it.
GEICO could help you save on your RV insurance, and that should make you and your RV very happy.
The Home Depot Project Loan is a simple way to put big projects within reach. You not only get no payments and no interest for 6 months, you also get the flexibility of paying it off anytime. So whether it's new flooring or a whole new kitchen, the Project Loan makes it easy and we make it possible. Get started now. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. U.S. only, subject to credit approval. Terms and conditions apply. See store for details.
Everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis from the wildly popular and always topical Foodie and the Beast.
Next Sunday, January 13th, we are kicking it off with coffee. Joel Finkelstein is in. He is the owner and head roaster at Quala Coffee. We're going to talk wine with Mira Winery out of California. And Joe Nathan is back. We're talking sips and sups.
That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live at 11 on 1500 AM.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan & Associates. And we have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Peter Rawlings, the managing partner with Environmental Resources Management, Dr. Jorge Haddock, dean of the George Mason University School of Management, Alan Horowitz, the president of Mainstream GS, and Paul Murray, the CFO with Digital Management, Inc. First up is Peter Rawlings, the managing partner with Environmental Resources Management. What is that?
Environmental Resources Management, or ERM. We love our acronyms in the industry we're in. We're one of the leading sustainability consultancies at a global level, where we're providing environmental, social, health and safety advice, support, and guidance for our clients.
What does sustainability mean?
Well, million-dollar question. There are many, many different definitions. At the highest level, I view it around really ensuring that how we live, behave, act today is not having an undue impact on future generations, our kids and their kids, in terms of their ability to lead and live their lives. If we bring it down to a business level, my personal definition, how I would view it, is really around ensuring that there is stakeholder, shareholder, and community value to the way companies run their businesses, operate their businesses. So that's social license to operate, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Of the two, which is more important to you?
Well, my day job is the consulting, advising the clients, so it's that latter one. It's really around operating the business, with due consideration to the way you operate, the efficiencies within which you operate the business, and the impact and the managing the risks your business has. Mm-hmm. The knock-on and positive effect is, by doing the job that I do, we do have those positive long-term benefits.
Great. When was the company founded?
ERM actually started as two separate entities, one here in the U.S., not far from here, just outside Philadelphia in the 70s, and another company called ERL in the U.K. And the two founders met, saw a lot of common ground, and merged to form ERM, Environmental Resources Management.
Mm-hmm. And how big or small is the firm today?
So we are now a company of about 4,500 employees across 40 countries, pretty much spanning North, South America, Africa, Asia, and Europe.
And when did you join the firm, Peter?
So I've been with them now for just over 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to join this place?
Well, I've been in the consultancy industry. When I graduated, my first job was in consultancy. I've loved the diversity, the challenge, the fact that every day you're learning new things, you're meeting interesting people, working on incredible projects. And I've always had my eye on ERM as a company I wanted to join. I don't know if I should admit it on radio, but it took me 3 attempts to join them. I got rejected twice before, but I finally made it, and I certainly don't regret that decision.
And now you're a managing partner.
Yeah, I now run and manage the Washington, D.C. operations. Uh-huh. I moved here about 7 months ago, so still finding our feet in the U.S. and in D.C., but loving it at the moment.
You tell us a funny story about your first experience in Washington, D.C. Share that with us.
Yeah, so I've grown up. My background in Africa, in Asia Pacific, and Australia, as well as the UK, where I'm originally from. Coming to the US within the first 3 or 4 weeks, thinking we're in one of the most developed nations, and the thing we found was we were a week without power due to some winds, the derecha, as it was called. So that was certainly a wake-up call.
And where are you from?
I'm originally from the UK, from Birmingham in the UK.
What was life growing up like there?
Well, I didn't really grow up there. I spent most of my childhood years in Africa. My dad worked in the mines and the paper and pulp industry in both Zambia and Swaziland. We had a few periods back in the UK, so the odd year here and there in Birmingham. So got good family and friends from the area. But also another part of the UK called Devon, which is where my dad's family are from. So a very mobile childhood.
How much of your youth was in Africa?
Oh, on and off, pretty much from, you know, about 6 months old through to 16 years.
What was that experience like?
It was great fun. It was very... you know, life was very independent. You fended for yourselves in terms of, you know, you didn't know from day to day what would be in the grocery stores. So if milk was in supply, then everyone would be dashing in getting the milk and stocking up for as much as possible. As a kid, it was great. You know, the going out into the surrounding area, the bush, as we called it, you know, getting up to trouble, groups of boys playing, you know, all sorts of exotic animals. We didn't know any different. But right. Sort of looking back, it was
looking
great.
Back on it, though, how do you think it shaped the man you are today?
Certainly given me a level of independence. Certainly given me that interest and desire to explore. You know, live now in quite a few different countries as part of my career. And I think that that interest in other countries, cultures, landscapes, etc., certainly stem from my time in Africa.
Do you think, and you've been many other places as well along the way.
Talk
about some of your other adventures.
Yes, sure. So having spent about the first 5 or 6 years of my career in the UK, predominantly in London, moved to Hong Kong, where I worked for 5 years with a construction firm. And that was fascinating because the role there was not just in Hong Kong, but across Asia Pacific. So really got the chance, both professionally and personally, to explore Asia, fascinating continent. And then we moved from there to Australia, lived in Sydney for 5 years before coming here. And Australia is an incredibly diverse, amazing country. So really got some experiences there.
So you've been to 3 or 4 radically different places throughout your lifetime so far. How do you think that shaped you as a leader?
I like to think that I have a good understanding and appreciation of, you know, people's perspectives, where they come from, what their backgrounds may be. And I certainly feel very comfortable engaging, speaking with people, with clients, with organizations, irrespective of where they're from, what their backgrounds are. And I like to think that's one of the strengths I bring.
Yeah. Do you think it's colored the way you, in the early days, how you consulted?
I think so. You know, I was at a boarding school for a number of years because there was no suitable schooling in Africa. So, yeah, a lot of life was about, you know, finding your way, consulting with colleagues, with friends, with enemies. I think that's certainly, I didn't know it at the time, but I certainly know it now.
Yeah. Talk about a moment when life was particularly tough for you.
When I was young, my parents did split up. I was about 7 or 8. It was probably tough in the sense that, you know, it meant we had to leave our life in Africa when we moved back to the UK for a period of time with my dad. But beyond that, I mean, it was our life. We knew no different. So I don't think it's had any long-term impacts or effects. The other period I'd say that was probably tough was, you know, tough but thoroughly rewarding was when our first child arrived. Mm-hmm. We probably made a very, when we look back on it, you know, it was a decision that some people might question. We changed country, so moved to Australia, changed jobs, joined ERM. My wife was 6 months pregnant and arrived in Australia, in Sydney, not really knowing anyone. So that was a tough time, sort of finding our bearings, becoming new parents.
Well, you tell an interesting story about your wife in the green room about how you met her and then you guys just start traveling together.
Yeah, we met at university in the UK. We, you know, each had our own careers and jobs for a number of years. We started living together in London, but we then sort of felt like we'd got as far as we could in our respective jobs in the UK. We both had that urge to experience something different, and that took us to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong to Australia, and now here we are with two kids in DC.
How long have you known her?
You're putting me on the spot now. I've known her since I was 18.
Yeah, it's a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time. 22 years.
And it sounds like a tremendous partnership that you two have.
Yeah. We, you know, Claire is a full-time mum at the moment looking after our kids. And that has probably allowed me to focus on my career.
Right.
So, you know, that it's a great partnership. I'm very grateful for that. And it works well. We're really enjoying life.
Other than the derecho, what's the biggest surprise the United States has shown you?
Biggest surprise? Well, for DC itself, I've loved meeting the diversity of people. I've been surprised at the intelligence of a lot of the people in that, you know, there's some incredibly clever people, and I certainly feel out of place at times when I'm in a room having discussions. Not so much surprising, I guess, was to be expected, but until you're living and experiencing it. But certainly food portions is
larger here.
Much, much larger than we're ever used to. So, and, you know, from the outside looking in, there's always this perception in America, you know, there's a culture of excess. And yes, we can certainly see that now we live here.
How about your proudest moment up till now, Peter?
You know, if I... not wanting to sound corny, of course, our two kids
are
absolutely incredible. I think I'm proud of most of what I have achieved and what my wife and I have done over the years. I don't think there's any one standout. You know, the sporting events where we, you know, may have won a particular event in a sport I've played, or career-wise, you know, I'm very proud of getting offered the job to come here. So there's a lot. There's no one standout.
Okay. What's the website address?
ERM.com. Very straightforward.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Peter Rawlings, who's the managing partner of Environmental Resources Management, or ERM. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan Associates, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight, brought to you by Peter Schwartz, a Vistage Chair with Vistage International. And joining us today is...
Pat Chance.
Pat, who are you with?
I am with CompuData, where I am the Director of Business Development in the D.C. metropolitan area.
And what is CompuData?
CompuData is a technology company delivering end-to-end solutions. And by that, we deliver business management software, which really includes Sage and Epicor ERP. Along with that, we also provide hardware, technical support and planning, hosting, disaster recovery, and professional services to meet the needs of our customers.
Wow. What makes your business special?
What makes our company so special? We've been in business now for 41 years. Our president and CEO is Angelina Doe, and she was honored most recently in Forbes magazine as the 100 most powerful women in business. Along with that, we've won many business awards, such as Accounting Technology, VAR 100, and the Business Journal.
Ooh. And what do you enjoy most about your job?
I enjoy helping companies and, most importantly, people. Helping them find the right solution to run their businesses effectively.
And why do you think your customers appreciate you?
They appreciate us because we are the trusted advisor. They depend on CompuData to deliver the right solution to help run their businesses.
How can someone reach you?
At www.compudata.com, and please visit me on LinkedIn.
That's great. We've been speaking with Pat, who's with CompuData. This is Peter Schwartz, and this has been your Spotlight for the day. Have a great day. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan and Associates. For this segment, we have Dr. Jorge Haddock, who is the Dean of George Mason University School of Management. Tell us a little bit more about the School of Management, Doctor.
The School of Management is one of the two largest schools at Mason, 4,500 students, mostly undergraduate. We have some interesting graduate programs at the traditional MBA, and then a couple of executive programs like management of technology and cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm. When was the school founded?
The school was founded about 33 years ago, so that would make it 19. You can do the math.
Yeah, 33 years. That's a long time. 33
years ago,
we're actually
yes.
Not all that long from a university standard, right?
Correct.
When did you join the organization?
3.5 years ago in 2009, summer of 2009.
Uh-huh. Why did you want to become dean of this particular school?
I think the school had achieved amazing levels of success globally, locally, obviously regionally, but it had a lot of potential. And the reach of our faculty, we have students from over 120 countries and faculty from many, many countries. And like 80 languages are spoken. So when you're in a school like that, you're really, you can reach the whole world through the students, the faculty, and the programs.
So would you say your curriculum is internationally focused?
Well, I think nowadays global business is almost an oxymoron. I mean,
right.
Business has to be global, and so is our curriculum and the environment in the classroom, because we have people from so many countries and so many languages are spoken. It just is part of the DNA.
Is it part of the university's attention to attract such a diverse student body?
I think it happened organically. I think that it happened by being where we are in a city close to D.C. and
right.
Just the nature of the population.
Mm-hmm. And why do you suppose you were the ideal pick? I know you had to compete for this position, so why do you think you were the ideal pick, without being modest here?
Well, I think deans have to be scholars, and they have to be salespeople in terms of the fundraising, and they have to be also leaders and managers, and they have to be able, in my case, understand the business world. And I think that because I had this strong academic background with my publication record and my achievements as a scholar, and I had proven myself to be a good fundraiser when I was the dean of the School of Business at Richmond. Plus, I convinced them that I was a person to lead the school into what was the next level.
Yeah. Now, I would never associate fundraising with a dean of a business school. So what is it about fundraising that's such an important aspect of the role that you play?
Well, education in the U.S. continues to be increasingly expensive, and I think that tuition just covers a percentage of the cost of educating a student. The state provides a percentage. And universities are increasingly dependent on private money
mm-hmm.
for the education of the student. And otherwise, I think the quality of the education would suffer.
Mm-hmm. And you said there were two other attributes, a good business background as well as being able to lead and manage. Tell us about your business background a little bit.
Well, I think if you go back to my newspaper route, maybe that could be the beginning. I became a salesman, believe it or not, at the age of 13. That was a pilot program in Puerto Rico. It was the Department of Commerce was trying to keep the kids off the street in the summer, and they gave us opportunity to go and work in a real job. I was selling men's clothing since I was 13, and I just fell in love with business. At the same time, I wanted to be an engineer and a teacher, and I've been able to combine all three.
Uh-huh. And where did you learn how to lead and manage?
The leading and the managing, I think, became natural for me since I was a teenager. I was the president of the class, or I was the president of the Lions Club, or the children's one was called Leo Club for mm-hmm. the Lions Club, and I always had leadership roles. And then as a professor, the same way. As a professor, you have to manage whether it's a curriculum development or you're managing some of the student clubs. And I had a department chair who was very conscientious of that. He was conscious about the importance of developing my leadership skills, and he gave me a lot of opportunities along the way.
So you would think a guy that had a paper route and was as entrepreneurial as you were at 13 would have gone into business as opposed to academics. Why did you choose academics?
I think that my plan was always, since I went to college and I saw some of my professors, my plan was very, very calculated, was very well planned. I planned to become a full professor, which is the highest rank, and then I wanted to do consulting. And I was very fortunate that I was able to do that before becoming a dean. Not only I did a lot of consulting, I did a lot of consulting in many different industries, Wall Street, the shipping industry, manufacturing. So I had a lot of opportunities to work with many talented people in the business world as a consultant. And again, I had to sell the project. I was a one-person show. I had to sell the project, deliver the project, write the report, and send the invoice, and even make the deposit in the bank. deposit the check in the bank.
So you've been in education for approximately how long now?
Well, I got my first teaching job before I went to graduate school, because again I was recruited when I finished my undergraduate to go to graduate school by the university, so then I would go back to be a professor. So that was in 1978. Again, you can do the math. I've been more than half of my life I have been a professor.
What would you say is the biggest change that has occurred across those years that you've experienced?
I think that students nowadays are more conscientious about their career path. And many students are going to college knowing not only the job that they want, but even the company they want to work for. I think that the technology has changed a lot. I mean, when I went to college, the professor used to say that we were going to have one day calculators embedded on the desk, and we thought, oh my God, that never happened. And nowadays they have computers and all the technology we have.
How has the internet changed your business?
The internet has created many opportunities for students. Talking about the internet and technology, you can go in many directions. But let's say on the teaching side, it has enabled more learning approaches and opportunities for many opportunities for different learning styles.
Yeah, because I would have thought initially if you weren't in the classroom, something would be missed. But you're saying that's not true necessarily.
With the online education, with the internet. Well, now on the internet, you can stop it, you can rewind it, you can buy, you can skip, you can learn at your own pace.
Right.
You can also learn from multiple sources. If you do not understand this professor, you can Google a different professor.
Right.
Then on the delivery side, you have the more competition because students can do a master's program online and they could be miles and miles away.
Yeah. What makes you so excited about the role you're in right now?
I think when you look at the potential for universities to be innovative, is a business model. You have to think about a business model. What is your competition? What is the opportunity? What do the student want? If you think about even, you can take one example. When I went to school, you wanted to go to the graduate program that was the most demanding, that was the most rigorous. And nowadays, students want to be the one that has the best reputation, that is most convenient to them.
Right.
So it's a continuous marketing research, looking at what the student wants, what the student needs, what the competition is doing. Sources of revenue, looking at quality. It's just like running a business.
Yeah. Where are you from, doctor?
I'm originally from Puerto Rico.
What was that like growing up in Puerto Rico for you?
When you grow up in an island, you really don't have much of a frame of reference. I mean, we've been a colony for over 100 years, so we looked a lot to the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
But we had a lot of influence from Europe and even from Africa, so mm-hmm. you have a lot of, it's a mix.
Yeah. How about the family you grew up in? Tell us a little bit about that.
Divorced mom, teacher. We had I had a dad, but he was not able to support us financially. It was difficult.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters. I was sandwiched in the middle.
Uh-huh.
An oldest sister and a younger sister.
So your mom worked and raised three kids?
Yep.
And that's not all, apparently.
Well, she went to graduate school. She got a master's degree. At the time, it was very unusual. We got the support of our grandparents, so my grandfather had a lot of influence. But nevertheless, she took a lot of the credit for that.
So that must have been something to watch, a working mother raising three kids by herself, essentially putting herself through a graduate program?
Mm-hmm.
How did that impact you?
Let me see. I was very focused. I knew what I wanted, and I was very disciplined. I remember she always said, at the time it's different now, but at the time if you wanted to study engineering, there was only one university in Puerto Rico where you could study engineering. Now there are many more. And if you didn't get into that college because you didn't have the grades or you didn't pass the SAT or the equivalent of the SAT, then you could not study engineering. So she was always, since I was like in elementary school, disciplined and you have to be a good student. And I think that discipline is what I've been able to keep through my life.
Mm-hmm. You also speak about the influence of your grandfather. Say a little bit about him.
Very hardworking, family oriented, good temper, which I didn't get that from him. just a family man. He was a very good person, good person to aspire to be like.
Right, right. What would you say the most difficult thing you've ever accomplished is?
I think the most difficult thing, geez, how many hours do we have? Well, I think that if I have to pick one, perhaps graduate school, coming to upstate New York,
right,
not knowing anybody, not hardly speaking any English, and being too ambitious. I mean, that was self-imposed. I finished my master's degree in two semesters when I didn't have to. I think that perhaps is the most difficult. Uh-huh. And then tenure, man. To be tenure nowadays is just so difficult.
Right. How about your proudest moment up to now?
My family has to be.
Yeah. What's the website address for the school?
School of Management at George Mason University. So it's som.gmu.edu.
Okay, great. We've been speaking with Dr. Jorge Haddock, who's the dean of the George Mason School of Management. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan & Associates. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan & Associates. For this segment, we have Alan Horowitz, who's the president of Mainstream GS. What is Mainstream GS, Alan?
We are a veteran-owned management consulting company. We work with government and commercial clients across the country and overseas. We help them increase their performance and sustain gains from those increased performances.
When was the company founded?
1999.
And how big or small are you guys today?
We're approximately 50 people.
Uh-huh. And you are the president?
I am.
When did you join the firm?
I joined the firm in 2008 as Senior Vice President of Public Sector Programs, and I became president of the company in January 2009, so I'll be celebrating 4 years as president this month.
Congratulations. What is it about this company that made it interesting enough for you to want to join it?
Well, I really love what we do for customers. So I came from an IT background. And, you know, I tell a story that it took 12 people to get a parking decal at Pearl Harbor, and we put some technology in, and now it takes 13 people to get a parking decal at Pearl Harbor. So we got technology in, but we really didn't help the process. And what was really exciting to me about Mainstream is we're really focused on the business process, so the business side of organizations, and helping them be more efficient and more effective. And that really made a difference for me in terms of coming in and helping customers be more successful. So it wasn't just about technology. It's about improving business performance.
Yeah, on your website, the line you have here is provide high-impact results driven that translate into tangible value by building knowledge and skills. How do you go about doing building knowledge and skills? And you mentioned motivation, by the way. How do you do that?
Well, it all starts, we're in the people business. And we are a team of broad and deep management consultants. And what we're about is working with customers, first and foremost, listening to what their key challenges are, and then transferring knowledge and best practices that we have acquired over the years in helping them be successful. And eventually, this sounds counterintuitive to a guy running a company, but we try to work ourselves out of a job over time by transferring knowledge and building self-sufficiency in the customer on the problem that we were brought in to solve. But what happens is you do a good job with that, they have another problem that they want you to come in. And so our goal is not to become part of the furniture and just be around as a long-term consultant, but to identify a problem, transfer knowledge on how to solve it, and then move on.
So this problem that you're so good at identifying and addressing, is it a technology problem or a people problem?
Always comes back to people. And I've said this many times, if you take all the people out of the equation, everything runs really smoothly. And one of the biggest challenges around the people piece is resistance to change.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to get better at something, you probably need to change something in the way that you're doing today. But there is an enormous resistance to change amongst people because that's the way we've always done it. We try to break that down. We try to get people to look and see how they might be able to change things to become more efficient and more effective.
Aren't you met with a little distrust in the beginning?
Sure. I think all consultants are, no matter what you're doing, because there are people in the organization that are saying, why are these guys here? That's my job. Well, if you look at it in terms of we're here to help you be even more successful than you are today, we're not here to replace you. We're not here to eliminate your position. We're here to help your organization be more productive. We're going to be a coach to help you do that, and then we're going to move on and do something else.
Yeah. Looking back on it, is there one ingredient that seems to lend itself to more than anything else that impacts change or impedes change?
You've got to get the leadership on board. That is the number one thing. If the people you're working with don't see that their boss is supportive of this or their boss's boss is supportive of this, then that's just the flavor of the day. And a lot of people will try to just wait out that effort and wait till those people move on and then go back to doing what they're doing.
You're clearly passionate about this. Why is this so much fun for you?
Well, it's really impressive and exciting, I think, for me and for us to make real changes for people. One of our clients, a military client, we worked with them, and I'll give you an example of how this, you know, overcoming change really helped them. So their number one issue was cost. It turns out the biggest driver for them in cost was fuel costs, and they are a big transport organization. Well, they're spending tons of money transporting materials and people all around the world, and we went in and really broke down everything that they did from end to end, from the time they got ready to load the planes until they took off. And we used a process that we call the five whys. We just kept asking, why do you do that? Why do you do that? Is there a law or reason? And there wasn't. And it turned out they were doing what you might call, you've heard of just-in-time inventory, they were doing just-in-case. So they were loading everything up on the plane they possibly could. As a result, they had to put more fuel in. And when they were getting ready to land, they had too much fuel. They had to dump fuel in the water.
Wow.
We got them to change that. They save $42 million a year on fuel costs going the exact same routes.
So doesn't it take you're born with this or you develop it over time, this willingness to ask the why questions and not be wedded to a particular answer?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you can learn it. I don't think it's rocket science. It's really being, you know, able to dive in there and really ask the right questions.
When did you develop it? When did the light go on for you? It's all about the why.
I think I've seen this for a long time. I've seen this even prior to coming to Mainstream. I've been with Mainstream, you know, since 2008, but I've seen it prior to then. The resistance to change is you can't grow. You can't. It's like, you know, if a shark stops moving, it dies.
Yeah.
And I think you have to have that same mentality, especially in today's business. Whether you're a government organization with decreasing budgets or you're a commercial organization trying to figure out how to balance your books.
So where were you before this?
I was with Microsoft Corporation for 17 years. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the experience. You got started in the early days of it.
I did, yeah. I joined the company in 1991. We were I think if you're part of a
fabulous
company that long. And I still have great friends and relationships there. We were a very different company back then. When I joined the company, we had about 10% market share in word processing, less than 15% in spreadsheets. So we were kind of an up-and-coming type of company. It was fantastic because everybody knew everybody. There was a lot of agility in decision-making. So there wasn't a lot of bureaucracy. We were able to look at things and get things done. And it was a very exciting time.
It's so interesting how things, the more things change, the more things stay the same. Agility was the way you made it back then. It's suddenly back in the vernacular now.
Yeah, I think especially today, all across business, you've really got to be agile. And you've got to be agile and creative. Not just agile to go in a different direction, but be creative and try to stay one step ahead of the competition.
So what did you get to work with Bill Gates at all? And
I did. Yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity. I was based here in Washington, D.C., and I was in the early days, I was running the marketing operation, and so I would be responsible for his itinerary and taking him around town with our teams to meet customers, and so got to spend some good time with
looking
him.
Looking back on it, how do you think you were influenced by him?
Well, I think one of the things that I really took away from that is here was one of the most brilliant guys in the world, and he was really able to break things down at a basic level and talking with customers. So a lot of customers were thinking they were going to have a very deep and very complex conversation with them. They could, but where he was most effective was really talking at what I would call a 100 level, just talking real basic to people and get them to understand how software could help change their environment.
Yeah. Where are you from, Ellen?
I was born and raised here in Washington, D.C.
And Mom and Dad, what were they doing growing up?
Well, my dad, he's a World War II veteran. He's going to be 90 this year, and he was a government civil servant. And my mom raised four kids. She had a harder job than my dad.
Yeah. And where were you in the birth order?
I was the youngest.
And what was
and
that?
Still am.
What was that like?
It was a great learning experience for me because I was able to see all the things I probably shouldn't be doing, and watching my older siblings go through the growth process, and so I was able to really observe and then, you know, make some maybe better decisions along the way.
What do you suppose your father's influence was on you?
I think one of the biggest things he influenced on me was what I would call plan the work and work the plan. Uh-huh. So really having a good approach, being methodical about it and sticking with it, and that usually served me well.
Yeah. How about your mom?
I think my mom, just her sense of humor and you know, her outlook on life was great growing up, and she's going to be 85 this year, so she's doing well, and I'm blessed to have them live nearby in the area and get to see them.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
Well, my proudest moment was probably meeting my wife and then starting a family more than anything else. And I would say from a business standpoint, probably my proudest moment was at Microsoft. It was a very entrepreneurial company. You could come up with ideas, develop a business plan, and launch a business. And I did that for the company in starting them in the consulting and product support business with the government, a customer that was suing us at the time, and end up starting with nothing. and building what ended up being a very large and successful business that I left in good hands when I left the company.
Congratulations. What's the website address for Mainstream?
MainstreamGS.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Alan Horowitz, who's the president of Mainstream GS. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan & Associates. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight, brought to you by Peter Schwartz with Vistage. And joining us today is?
Steven Seiden.
Steve, what's the name of your organization?
Learn to See.
Learn to See? What's Learn to See?
Learn to See is a peer group organization where we're trying to get people that are like-minded with like experiences to go deeper into their own self.
So give me an example of what that means, really.
That means to grow your self-awareness.
And why is that important?
Because as people and as CEOs and as leaders and in any walks of life, it's very important that we understand where our blind spots are and try to help move our own blind spots.
So for somebody that's curious what a blind spot is, somebody listening in and they're curious about theirs, how would you describe a blind spot?
A blind spot is when you end up somehow tripping over your own feet or doing something that you're not even know you're doing because you don't have perspective from yourself or from others.
And because of that, it gets in the way of your results?
Absolutely.
Why is this so important to you?
Because as a CEO and as a leader and as a father and as a brother and in all the roles I've played, I've learned that I've had to be able to acknowledge my own strengths and weaknesses and figure out where I can grow and where I can be the best person I can be.
How can someone find out more about this organization?
You can go to the website. It's learn2C.net.
Say that one more time.
Learn2C.net.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Steve Seiden. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Colin Callahan & Associates. And for this segment, we have Paul Murray, who's the CFO of Digital Management, Inc. What is Digital Management, Inc., Paul?
Digital Management, or DMI, is a government contracting firm specializing in IT services and enterprise mobility.
Say a little bit more. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, we provide services to the government, IT services from app development to managed services to strategy consultant.
Mm-hmm.
We're also focusing on enterprise mobility. We recently acquired two companies in the mobile device management space, and we've acquired an application development firm that specializes in mobile development.
Yeah. When was the company founded?
2002.
And how big or small are you today?
We will be in 2013 about $250 million in revenue, and we have 1,200 employees.
That's a lot of growth over 10 plus a little years.
Sonny Bajaj learned from his dad, Ken, how to grow the company.
Uh-huh.
So it's been a fun ride. I've been there since March of this past year.
Uh-huh.
We basically have more than doubled in size. I think I started, we were at 530 employees. So it's been, we've won some major contracts this year and on a great curve.
What is it that, you know, this isn't the first time you've been around a fast-growing company. What is it that you've discovered as characteristics of successful, fast-growing companies? What do they do better than everybody else?
I've always found that a management team that works together, that really understands the strategy and can work together, sometimes having a management team that doesn't have to meet to have each other's back, it's a little bit of a cliche, but really on the same page, running the same play. I think companies that can do the basics very well are also able to grow because you're not worrying about the most simple things. You can start worrying about expanding your reach.
Yeah, but I don't think that happens just by accident. How does a team like that come to be?
I think you need to have, it always starts at the top. You need to have a leader that has the vision of where you're going and the ability to pick the right people to work with. Because easily one bad apple does spoil the bunch.
Yeah.
And you've got to have a team that works together.
So did Ken seek you out to be a part of this?
He did, actually. Ken and another gentleman, Scott Deutschman, I'd met about 7 years ago. I was trying to sell him I joke I was trying to sell them the companies I was with, and they didn't buy them. I kept harassing them that they needed to buy them because I wanted to work for them. But 7 years later, they actually reached out to me to come join them.
Yeah.
And you know, join Sonny's company.
So if what you say is true, it's all about the quality of the management team. What is it about you that's so valuable in the role of CFO, without being modest?
Well, I think I'm a little bit of a different CFO. I've got a little bit of a sales side to me. Not that I've ever been in sales, but I have a personality, and I think that's important. In this day and age, from an M&A or growth perspective, a CFO has got to be able to deal with a bank. It's got to be able to deal with companies that you're trying to acquire, build a rapport. Being a bean counter that sits in the room with your door closed, that's just not going to cut it anymore.
And for most people listening in, I hear the role of chief financial officer. They think it's just about counting the money. What? Correct the myth. What's really going on there?
Yeah, I think that's, if I look at my job today, that's probably about 25 or 20% of it.
The other
80% is really working on strategy and how we're going to execute that strategy and timeline, making sure we have the resources to execute the strategy. In my role, my controller is really the one that's back there counting the beans, as I like to say, and making sure the train runs on time, that we close the books each right. month, that we're invoicing right. on time, all that. I need that to happen so I can focus on the other 80%, because that's really where the value is being created.
Yeah. When did finance become your career choice?
I always joke it started when I started my paper out when I was 10 years old. You know, having to walk through the neighborhood and collect money and shake down people to get their past due bill. I still have nightmares sometimes that I have customers that are 2 months past due or something. But it really started then, and then it carried on to when I went to college. My fraternity brothers got jobs my freshman year, and so I followed their path and got a job, you know, my senior year as well in public accounting with BDO Seidman. And then I really, from there, worked my way up through the controller ranks and became a CFO, you know, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago.
Yeah. You were telling us a story in the green room where the paper route just wasn't a paper route. You actually expanded that because of relationships. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think my M&A experience started then. I did some hostile takeovers of my friends' routes that were near me, because I learned that, you know, getting up maybe 5 minutes earlier, I could get more papers done. And so it really started then to expand what I was doing as I got more efficient, especially when I got to get my driver's license. I could really expand the network, the empire. But it was fun. But you joke about it, but it really was running your own business at a young age. And you learned, you know, I have to collect money. I have to negotiate the rate with the Washington Post dealer to make sure he's not sticking it to you, and that you're able to make it work all at the end of the day.
But you learned what I learned as a fundamental business lesson, that about cross-selling. You could sell more things to a satisfied customer than find new customers.
Exactly. I expanded into the grass cutting, the painting business, washing cars, you name it. I was your guy to hire it. But you're exactly right that a new customer costs a lot of money to get, and you learn that even in business today, that it's so much easier to sell to who you have. And also it makes you listen to what that customer needs and wants, because it may be something different than what your business is doing today.
So where'd you grow up, Paul?
I'm local. Grew up in Kensington.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Georgetown Prep. And I always joke I was a kid from the wrong side of the tracks at Prep, but I was able to go there luckily on some scholarships from Prep, and was able then to move on to the University of Richmond. And was able to spend time as a spider.
Yeah. You're the youngest of five, and I understand your dad died when you were a young man, a young boy, actually.
Yeah, my dad was four, died of a heart attack. My mother, Rosie, as we call her, raised five kids, did a wonderful job, hard worker.
Worked and raised five kids.
Yeah. Thank God I think I turned out okay. I didn't provide too many problems for her. But
what do you suppose it was like, looking back on it, how were you shaped by all of that?
Well, I think it made me extremely independent and aware of my surroundings, of knowing that, you know, I was a little bit different. You know, maybe today it'd be different with a single mom, but back then it was definitely more out of the norm that, you know, you didn't have a mom and a dad. But my mom did a great job of raising me. You know, hard work was instilled in me early. To this day, my 90-year-old mother is still working, you know, her sewing business. I saw it firsthand back then. She worked in the government as a personnel assistant. I always joke I made more money on my first job in public accounting than she did after she had worked, you know, 15, 16 years. But it always made me, you know, appreciate what she did provide. I don't think I was someone I missed out on anything. If anything, I had a great perspective of learning to work hard.
What'd you do with the money you made from the paper route?
Well, it was used, you know, we joked in the green room that I had it invested in like 16% CDs at Perpetual Federal or Savings Bank. I don't think we're getting those rates right now, even in Europe. But, you know, I used it. I still have my first car that I bought. I have a 78 Volkswagen Bug convertible. I still own it today. I think it keeps me grounded of what it took me to buy that car. It paid my way to college. I ended up going to Richmond. Between aid and my money, I was able to pay for that completely. And so I worked hard and I got, you know, rewarded from that.
Besides your mom, talk about some other significant influences and role models along the way.
Well, I think my brother, Phil, I mean, most of my brothers and sisters in general, if they set the bar, you know, starting at the top, you know, my sister and my brother, everyone in my family has an advanced degree. They all graduated college. My next brother, Phil, is 8 years older than me. He's probably been the most significant influence. He's one that really stressed, you know, getting it done and independence and hard work. And, you know, he really made sure probably from the very beginning that I was always, you know, grounded and knew what I needed to do to get to the next level.
Yeah. So you've lived through the dot-com craze, including enjoyed some successes and some busts. As a CFO, what's it like to have to communicate bad news?
Well, it's certainly not something you look forward to. I think it's one of the worst things. I think the worst is when you're having to communicate not just to the CEO but to employees, that whether it's be a reduction in force or making those employees cut their pay because it's for the survival of the company. You know, it's one of those things you definitely don't. That's not the fun part of being a CFO.
Yeah.
The fun part is when the result of those actions, that you're able to turn the business around. And I've successfully twice done that by having to cut back employees' pay. And luckily, I've gotten lucky both times that it's worked out. But there are those stories that it doesn't. I think it makes you be certainly more cautious as a CFO, because it's easy to be a great CFO in good times. It's probably, you know, you've got to be a great CFO in bad times.
Right. What's your proudest moment up till now?
Well, I've had a couple. I would say, you know, to date, probably when we sold Proxicom, which was the second go-round of Proxicom. We were part of the Gores Group. We sold it to iCrossing in 2007. Proxicom was bought by Gores literally on the scrap heap after Dimension Data sold it. Again, we went back to that formula we talked about. We had a great management team. We were able to basically double that business in about 2.5 year time frame, from about $26 million in revenue to $52 million, and we sold it for a great profit to iCrossing. It was really satisfying, and, you know, kind of really confirmed my playbook that you can do it.
Good for you. What's the website address for DMI?
DMINC.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Paul Murray, who's the CFO with Digital Management Inc. I'd like to thank my co-host Colin Callahan with Colin Callahan and Associates. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Peter Rawlings, the managing partner for ERM, or Environmental Resources Management, Dr. Jorge Haddock, the dean for the George Mason School of Management, Alan Horowitz, president of Mainstream GS, and Paul Murray, CFO, Digital Management, Inc. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders, and I'd like to thank you, our listening audience. For without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. Happy New Year, everyone. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy.